This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of tibial plafond fractures from the trauma section on orthobullets.com. Tibial plafond fractures are also known as pilon fractures. As far as the epidemiology, they account for less than 10% of lower extremity injuries. However, the incidence is increasing as survival rates after motor vehicle collisions increase. As far as the demographic, the average patient age is 35 to 40 years old, and tibial plafond fractures are more common in males than females. As far as the pathophysiology, with respect to mechanism, usually these injuries require a high-energy axial load from things like motor vehicle accidents and falls from a height. The pathoanatomy is often characterized by articular impaction and comminution, metaphyseal bone comminution, soft tissue injury, which is seen in open or Schirn types 2/3 closed fractures. Tibial plafond fractures are also associated with other musculoskeletal injuries. And finally, keep in mind three fragments that are typical with intact ankle ligaments include the medial malleolar fragment where the deltoid ligament attaches, the posterolateral or Volkmann fragment where the posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament attaches, and the anterolateral or Chaput fragment where the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament attaches. Again, the three fragments that are typical in tibial plafond fractures with intact ankle ligaments include the medial malleolar, where the deltoid ligament attaches, the posterolateral or Volkmann fragment, where the posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament attaches, and the anterolateral or Chaput fragment, where the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament attaches. As far as associated conditions with tibial plafond fractures, 75% have associated fibular fractures. As far as the prognosis for tibial plafond fractures, parameters that correlate with the poor clinical outcome and inability to return to work include lower level of education, pre-existing medical comorbidities, male sex, work-related injuries, and lower income levels. Now let's talk about some relevant anatomy. With respect to the osteology, the distal tibia forms an inferior quadrilateral surface and pyramid-shaped medial malleolus. The tibia articulates with the talus and the fibula laterally via the fibula notch. As far as the vascular anatomy, let's talk about the anterior tibial artery, the posterior tibial artery, and the peroneal artery. The anterior tibial artery is the first branch of the popliteal artery. It passes between the two heads of the tibialis posterior and the interosseous membrane. It lies anterior to the interosseous membrane between the tibialis anterior and the EHL, and it terminates as the dorsalis pedis artery. The posterior tibial artery continues in the deep posterior compartment of the leg. It courses obliquely to pass behind the medial malleolus and terminates by dividing into the medial and lateral plantar arteries. With respect to the peroneal artery, the main branch takes off 2.5 centimeters distal to the popliteal fossa. It continues in the deep posterior compartment between the tibialis posterior and the FHL, and it terminates as calcaneal branches. Finally, let's talk about some nerves, specifically the tibial nerve, the common peroneal nerve, the superficial peroneal nerve, the deep peroneal nerve, the saphenous nerve, and the sural nerve. The tibial nerve, which comes from L4 to S3, crosses over the popliteus from the popliteal fossa and splits the two heads of the gastrocnemius. It passes deep to the soleus, coursing to the posterior aspect of the medial malleolus. It terminates as the medial and lateral plantar nerves, and remember the muscular branches supply the posterior leg, that is the superficial and deep posterior compartments. The common peroneal nerve arises from L4 to S2, and it winds around the neck of the fibula and runs down to the peroneus longus. It divides into the superficial and deep peroneal nerves. Speaking of which, the superficial peroneal nerve courses along the border between the lateral and anterior compartments of the leg. It supplies muscular branches to the peroneus longus and brevis, which is found in the lateral compartment, and it terminates as the medial dorsal and intermediate dorsal cutaneous nerves. The deep peroneal nerve courses along the anterior surface of the interosseous membrane, and it supplies the musculature of the anterior compartment and sensation to the first web space. The saphenous nerve arises from L3 to L4 and is a continuation of the femoral nerve of the thigh. It becomes subcutaneous on the medial aspect of the knee between the sartorius and gracilis, and it supplies sensation to the medial aspect of the leg and the foot. The sural nerve, which arises from S1 to S2, is formed by the cutaneous branches of the tibial or the medial sural cutaneous and the cutaneous branches of the common peroneal or lateral sural cutaneous nerves. The sural nerve lies on the lateral aspect of the leg and the foot. Now let's talk about the classification of tibial plafond fractures. The two to know are the AO/OTA classification and the Rudy Allgauer classification. The AO/OTA classification is broken up into three types: 43A, 43B, and 43C. 43A is an extra-articular tibial plafond fracture, 43B is a partial articular tibial plafond fracture, and 43C is a complete articular tibial plafond fracture. Each category is further subdivided based on the amount and degree of comminution. The Rudy Allgauer classification is also divided into three types. Type 1 is non-displaced, type 2 is characterized by simple displacement with an incongruous joint, and type 3 is a comminuted articular surface. Like the AO/OTA classification, in the Rudy Allgauer classification, each category is further subdivided based on the amount and degree of comminution. As far as the presentation of tibial plafond fractures, symptoms include ankle pain, inability to bear weight, and deformity. Physical exams should involve inspection, assessment of range of motion and stability, as well as a neurovascular exam. As far as inspection, examine the soft tissue integrity for things like swelling, abrasions, ecchymosis, fracture blisters, and open wounds. Also examine for associated musculoskeletal injuries. As far as range of motion and stability testing, make sure to examine the stability and alignment of the ankle joint. Finally, as far as a neurovascular exam, make sure to check the DP and PT pulses, look for a neurologic compromise, and check for signs of compartment syndrome. With respect to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP, lateral, mortise, and keep in mind that full-length tibia/fibula and foot x-rays should be performed for fracture extension. Findings on plain films may include four characteristic fragments: the medial malleolus, the anterior malleolus or the Chaput fragment, the lateral malleolus or the Wagstaff fragment, and the posterior malleolus or the Volkmann fragment. A CT scan is useful to delineate articular involvement. It's also useful for surgical planning, and it's most useful after ligamentotaxis is provided by a spanning external fixator. Treatment for tibial plafond fractures can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management involves immobilization, which is involved for stable fracture patterns without articular surface displacement. It's also indicated for critically ill or non-ambulatory patients, or patients with significant risk of skin problems like diabetes, vascular disease, and neuropathy. The technique of immobilization involves a long leg cast for 6 weeks, followed by a fracture brace and range of motion exercises. Alternative treatment is with early range of motion. As far as outcomes, intra-articular fragments are unlikely to reduce with manipulation or displaced fractures. Loss of reduction is common, and inability to monitor soft tissues is a major disadvantage. Operative options include a temporizing spanning external fixation across the ankle joint, open reduction internal fixation, external fixation alone, or intramedullary nailing with percutaneous screw fixation. A temporary spanning external fixation across the ankle joint is indicated for acute management, where it provides stabilization to allow for soft tissue healing. It's also indicated for fractures with significant joint depression or displacement. And keep in mind that a temporizing spanning external fixation across the ankle joint is usually left until the swelling resolves, generally 10 to 14 days. An ORIF is indicated for definitive fixation for a majority of pilon fractures. However, limited or definitive ORIF can be performed acutely with low complications in certain situations. As far as outcomes, the ability to drive is an important endpoint, and remember that brake travel time returns to normal 6 weeks after weight-bearing. Again, brake travel time returns to normal 6 weeks after weight-bearing. As far as external fixation alone, this may be indicated in select cases. Intramedullary nailing with percutaneous screw fixation is an alternative to ORIF for fractures with simple intra-articular components, for example, an AO-OTA 43C1/C2. Now, let's talk about some of these techniques in a bit more detail. With respect to external fixation, fixation involves a joint-spanning articulated versus non-spanning hybrid ring. None have been shown to be superior with respect to ankle stiffness. This option typically involves two tibial shaft half pins connected to the hind foot half pins or calcaneal transfixation pin. With hybrid fixators, thin wires may be placed within the joint capsule or within the zone of injury. With respect to the soft tissues, make sure to maintain soft tissue attachments of the fragments. For example, the Chaput fragment has the soft tissue attachment of the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament. The pros of external fixation include that it has decreased incidence of wound complications and deep infections compared to ORIF, and you can also combine it with limited percutaneous fixation using lag screws. The cons of external fixation include pin and wire tract infections, loss of ankle motion, injury to neurovascular structures, and anatomic articular reconstruction may not be possible, especially with central depression. Moving on to ORIF, with respect to the approach, this includes the use of multiple small incisions that can include the direct anterior approach to the ankle, anterolateral approach to the ankle, anteromedial approach to the ankle, medial approach, posteromedial approach, posterolateral approach, or the lateral approach. With respect to the anterolateral approach to the ankle, this is particularly useful with fractures impacted in valgus or with an intact fibula. This approach puts the deep peroneal nerve at risk during exposure, but keep in mind that this approach puts the deep peroneal nerve at risk during exposure and dissection in the anterior compartment. The superficial peroneal nerve is at risk during superficial dissection in the lateral compartment. Again, the anterolateral approach puts the deep peroneal nerve at risk during exposure and dissection in the anterior compartment, and the superficial peroneal nerve is at risk during superficial dissection in the lateral compartment. If you're going to be doing an ORIF, you must respect the soft tissues, so keep in mind that generally a greater than 7 cm skin bridge should be used with full thickness skin flaps. The goals of ORIF is for an anatomic reduction of the articular surface, restoring length, reconstructing the metaphyseal shell, using bone graft if needed, and reattaching the metaphysis to the diaphysis. The steps in ORIF include reducing and instrumenting the fibula to establish lateral column length if needed, and keep in mind that when compared to no instrumentation of the fibula, there is no difference in alignment or reduction, but there is higher rates of fibular hardware removal. After reducing and instrumenting the fibula to establish lateral column length if needed, you will reduce the articular surface and then reattach the articular block to the metaphysis and the shaft. With respect to fixation, this may be augmented with external fixation with or without limited open reduction internal fixation. You can use anterolateral, anterior, anteromedial, medial, or posterior plating techniques for the tibia, and keep in mind that the location of plates/screws are fracture and soft tissue dependent. ORIF of the fibula should be done if needed. This can be done with intramedullary screw/wires or plate/screw constructs. The pros of an ORIF are direct anatomic reduction, rigid fixation, and early motion of the ankle. Keep in mind that clinical improvement may occur for up to 2 years. The cons of ORIF is that there is a high incidence of soft tissue complications and infection without staged open reduction and internal fixation. Finally, let's talk about some surgical complications, specifically wound sloughing, dehiscence, infection, varus malunion, non-union, post-traumatic arthritis, chondrolysis, and stiffness. With respect to wound sloughing, this occurs in 10% of patients, and with this complication, a free flap can be done for postoperative wound breakdown. Dehiscence occurs in 9 to 30% of patients. To try to avoid this complication, you should wait for soft tissue edema to subside before open reduction internal fixation at 1 to 2 weeks. Infection is seen in 5 to 15% of cases. Non-union usually occurs at the metaphyseal junction, and this is treated with bone grafting and plate fixation, and non-unions are more common with hybrid fixation. Finally, post-traumatic arthritis most commonly begins 1 to 2 years post-injury. Arthrodesis is not commonly required until many years later, and what's important to remember is chondrocyte cell death at the fracture margins is a contributing factor. Again, with respect to post-traumatic arthritis, chondrocyte cell death at the fracture margins is a contributing factor. That's all for this review about tibial plafond fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.